This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Coaching, training, or leadership-related fields, there's almost no need to introduce our guest today, but here I go anyway. He's a number one New York Times bestselling author and also Business Insider and Inc.'s most influential leadership expert. We have John C. Maxwell today here. He's the founder of the John Maxwell Company, Team, Leadership Foundation, as well as Equip. And he's on the phone with me to discuss his new book, Leadershift, 11 Essential Changes Every Leader Must Embrace. So you're listening to Raise Your Game with Christine Wong. Thank you so much, John, for being on BFM today.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Christine, and all of your listeners.
All right. I think the first thing that I want to address is the fact that your book is all about the changes that a leader has to go through and the 11 changes that you went through as a leader as well throughout your career. But what is so challenging about change as a leader?
Leadership is constantly moving people through passages in their life that require change. And the reason I wrote this book is because change is happening so quickly now. Let me give a little bit of background, Christine. If you would go into a bookstore in the 1980s, you wouldn't have found any leadership books at all.
Right.
You would have just found you would have found management books. And everybody was wanting to manage their business. And Peter Drucker was the management guru. But it began to change in the early 90s because the speed of life was going so fast that you couldn't manage it. You had to get in front of it. You had to be out front. You had to be a leader. And so the leadership book started to really come, and I was in on that first wave.
Mm.
Well, we're coming now to a stage that it's going to another level. And this book, Leadershift, that I wanted to write, I've been wanting to write it for a few years. I felt that now was the time. Social media has just exploded everything, and I was probably the catalyst of writing the book was I was getting ready to speak for a company, and I was on a pre-call with them, and their theme was fast forward, Christine, and they asked me, John, what do you think about the theme fast forward? I said, well, I like it. And they said, what does it mean to you? I said, well, the word fast, what it really means to me is fast is faster. It's faster than it's ever been before.
Mm.
It's not going to slow down. I'm always amused when people say, you know, I'm just waiting for things to slow down so I can kind of think this through. And I tell them it's not going to slow down.
Right.
So, you know, fast is faster than it's ever been before. And forward is shorter than it's ever been before. Mm-hmm. My goodness. When I started out in leadership, we would look at our planning. We'd lay out a 10-year long-range plan, a 5-year mid-range plan, and a 2-year short-range plan. Well, today, a long-range plan is less than 2 years. I mean, everything's getting compacted. Everything is, you know, forward is shorter, faster is faster.
Mm.
And I say that because that's why leadership book is so important. It helps all leaders be able to maximize this very rapid speed that we're in and make changes that allow them to not only strengthen their leadership, but in a fast-changing society, even sustain it. So I'm very excited about the book because I think the book really allows people to learn how to make these changes, how to be adaptable, how to be flexible, how to be agile, so that they can really lead successfully in the next few years.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that is a main kind of concern for a lot of people, that everything is just moving kind of too fast and too much in a way. And one of the things that you say in the book as well is that, you know, that shift from management to leadership books and guides, right, was because that leadership provides principles that work in the face of the unknown. And unfortunately, we're like kind of surrounded by the unknown at the moment. As you mentioned, it's really important to be adaptable and flexible as well nowadays. And I won't go through all the points of the book. I think it's great if people listening will pick up the book for themselves. So I will leave a little bit for them to actually read for themselves too, obviously. But I do want to ask about a few of the main ideas from Leadershift. And chapter five, especially, this was really interesting to me. It was about going from pleasing people to challenging people. And I think that especially when a person in a team is promoted to a leadership position in that team, it can be difficult to make that transition from coworker to like kind of boss, essentially. So, you know, talk to me about that a little bit more. How does one make that change?
First of all, that was a very difficult change for me, Christine. I mistakenly thought that when I started leading that that if I was a good leader, everybody would like the direction I was going and buy into it and get on the leadership train. Everybody would be happy. And it was very obvious to me very quickly that when you do real leadership, that not everybody wants to follow, not everybody agrees with you. And I had to begin to say, okay, I'm going to have to make an adjustment. I'm going to have to change my kind of my definition of leadership from making people happy to helping people and making a difference in a positive way for them. I used to think I would relationally tie myself very tight to people. And then when it got difficult, they would follow me because they liked me. And I found that it wasn't true at all. The people only follow you as a leader at difficult times if you're competent and if you're really good. So instead of kind of waiting for the crisis to hit and then hoping my relationships could pull it off, I started having what I call upfront expectations. And that's just simply, Christine, I'd sit down with you and I'd say, okay, if you want to be on the team, let me just share some things with you that we kind of need to know up front and buy into. And in the book, I talk about some of them, things such as it's not about me, it's not about you, it's about the future, it's about the big picture, it's about the team. And I would expect if you join the team, for example, to keep growing. And that if you join the team, that you're going to accept responsibility. And one of the things I tell my friend is we're going to have tough conversations. If you join the team, we're going to have to sit down sometimes and have a conversation that I don't want, you don't want, but we have to have it. And it's going to happen. And it's okay. I just want you to know that we're going to have that. And I found that when you put up front expectations with people and you start that way, that when you have to have that tough conversation, they don't take it personal at all. They say, yeah, remember, you know, 6 months ago we talked about this and we're having one right now. And so I just discovered that if you really need the approval of people, you won't lead them well. So it's kind of like a little saying. I said, if you need people, you probably won't lead them really well.
Right.
And it's got to be the fact that I value them. I value them greatly, but I don't need their approval to lead. That's for sure.
I guess it's kind of like setting a precedent for the boundaries of like what your authority means, I suppose. Would you say that's about right?
Yes, I would say that is right.
Okay. That idea of needing approval as well. As a leader, you're going to have to make difficult decisions. So really what it boils down to is you're going to have to make tough calls regardless. So you shouldn't have to rely on your team's approval exactly to make those calls as well. And I think that part of that whole leadership journey is also not just making sure that you're improving as a leader yourself, but, you know, creating new leaders for the future as well, which you kind of discuss in Chapter 7. That's like ladder climbing to ladder building. So I think a lot of new leaders kind of get so caught up in trying to be a good leader that they forget part of their job is to also create future leaders as well, right? So I guess, how does one set that structure in place for the leaders to come?
Well, first of all, Christian, I love this chapter, right? It's one of my very favorite. What I do in the chapter is I take people through the process. It's the title of the chapter is Ladder Climbing to Ladder Building. And I talk about the fact that we all start off ladder climbing. And that's good, but we have to realize that if we're going to really build a great organization, we have to have other people, and those other people shouldn't be just holding the ladder for us, and we just got to be the solo leader. We need to start developing other leaders. So this is a shift where I go from, I talk in another part of the book about going from being a soloist to a conductor. And this is kind of where I get this mindset, this shift that, okay, not everybody here is to hold my ladder and let me be the only one leading. I've got to begin to empower and develop other leaders to climb. And so I go from ladder climbing, which I'm basically asking myself the question, how high can I go, to ladder holding. I now I'm holding someone else's ladder, and I ask myself the question, how high will others go if I give them some help? And what am I doing? I'm steadying the ladder. I'm holding the ladder for them. Why? So that it's secure, so they can maybe climb a few rungs higher than they would if somebody wasn't holding the ladder. And so I become a ladder holder. I have a good friend, Kevin Myers, who told me one time, he said, John, leaders should want more for their people than they want from their people.
Mm.
And I think that is so true. And ladder holding is, no longer am I waiting for you to hold my ladder so I can go high. I'm now holding your ladder. I'm wanting something for you more than I'm wanting something from you. And then the next phase is ladder extending. And what happens here is, when I'm holding the ladder, maybe I'm holding the ladder for you, Christine, mm-hmm. and you're climbing it, I'm going to find out how good you are with my help.
Right.
And this is where I began to pick the people that I pour into, or I began to pick the people that I mentor. And I really like this, because you got someone you're holding the ladder, they don't go very high. You say, okay, well, I helped them, but they're not going to really go really high even with my help. And then there are others that they just start climbing. And after a while, you say, oh, my goodness, this is somebody now that I want to do more than just hold the ladder. This is where I discover their potential. And that's when I go from what I call ladder holding to ladder extending.
Right.
And that now I'm saying how high can Christine go in my organization if she gets a lot of help and I help her really extend herself. I basically say I want to go from a ladder climber where I kind of climb myself and get some success to helping people by holding the ladder, then finding out the potential by extending it, and then eventually by helping them build their own ladder so they can be blessed and empowered to go do what they do best, which is in the long run, the highest compliment of a leader is that other leaders raise up under him or her and are able to do well on their own.
All right, it's time for a quick break now for a little bit of music, but after that, I'll continue speaking to John Maxwell about some other pertinent changes that leaders must embrace. And for more of that conversation, please stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Business, finance, and more. BFM 89.9.
This is Raise Your Game. I'm Christine Wong, and before the break, I was speaking to John C. Maxwell. I kind of barely have to introduce him, but he's the founder of the John Maxwell Company, Team Leadership Foundation, as well as Equip. He's also a number one New York Times best-selling author, and today we're discussing his new book, Leadershift, and why every leader kind of needs to leadershift and kind of embrace some of these changes as well. And before the break, we kind of talked about that shift from management to leadership, as well as going from pleasing people to challenging people, and also ladder climbing to ladder building. And we won't cover everything in the book because it would be great for everyone to go out and pick up a copy themselves. But this is just some of the key points that I was personally interested in as well. So the next one that I really wanted to ask you, John, about is chapter 9. You highlight a switch from team uniformity to team diversity. And I think diversity is a buzzword that, you know, gets thrown around a lot. But, you know, what kind of diversity are you exactly looking for in a team? And then why is that diversity important?
Well, it's essential to have a great team. Now, when I talk about diversity, everybody needs to be on the same page as far as vision and values. We all need to be going the same direction, and we need to be able to have pretty much the same values. But beyond that, I want a lot of diversity. With the speed of life and the way things are going now, I can't make the assumption that I have all the answers. And I certainly don't have all the answers if I just have one perspective. And so I need to have a team that's very diverse so that we can get together, huddle up, and very quickly come to some conclusions that would be full conclusions, not partial conclusions based upon just the lack of having people, what I call completeness. You see, when I develop a team in diversity, I have diversity and value it because that's how we complete one another. I mean, if you're on the team with me, Christine, you have different background, different experience, a lot younger, different ethnicity. You're going to come to the table, and when we discuss the important ideas, you're going to help me. You're going to give me things that I wouldn't have without you. And the moment that we begin to understand that, we begin to value one another. The moment we begin to value one another, we begin to value their opinions. And the moment we begin to value their opinions, the more we listen to them and ask more questions. And that's how we really develop a great company. And so, you know, diversity is just, it's huge. It fills in the knowledge gap. It literally helps us with a perspective of the experience gap. It just really expands our network, and I don't need a lot of people like me. If they're all like me, we're going to be in trouble. I've got to have people that compliment me with gifts that I don't have. It's not diversity in the end that I just want to have token diversity. I want to have diversity that really can bring stuff to the table and values one another enough to put it on the table so that we can all learn, we can all listen, and many times we can all change direction because of it.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I think that it's so important for leaders to kind of admit sometimes, you know, they don't necessarily have all the answers. I don't think any one person has, right? And, you know, that idea that diversity, and I love that you highlighted, you know, not just token diversity, but diversity for the sake of being able to challenge and complement each other on expansion of ideas. I think that's like the key kind of thinking that has to go into that. You can't just hire people just for like the sake of token diversity because it doesn't work that way, I suppose. So that's a really great point.
Christine, here's what I know, Christine. If you and I set the table, and I shared with you a leadership thought or a leadership idea,
right?
Within 10 minutes, you would give me insight that would make my thought, my idea better. I know you would. and that's why I seek out opinion. And I'm not looking for a consensus. I'm not looking for everybody to even agree. I'm just looking for diverse people giving me diverse thoughts and ideas so that I can begin to put them together to get the best idea.
Right.
And once you, everybody's my teacher. Everybody's my teacher. You don't get great answers because you're positionally over people. You get great answers because you value them and their opinions and you seek them out. And there's not a higher compliment I can give you than to say, Christine, what do you think about this? What do you suggest? What is your idea? How do you think we could become better? Mm-hmm. The moment I do that, I'm becoming very empowering to you.
Right.
And I'm beginning to place value on you. And what I learned was that my team members rise up to the value I place on them. They always do. If I come to the table and I respect you and value you and I have, quote, an 8 or a 10 on your head, guess what? You're going to give me the return of an 8 or a 10. You're going to meet those expectations.
Actually, that's a really great segue into the next question I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned this idea of, like, you know, when you ask your team and you talk to them and you know, you learn from everyone. And the next question I really wanted to ask you was about chapter 10, which is about the switch from positional authority to moral authority, which I think is particularly pertinent to Malaysian or kind of Southeast Asian listeners, because unfortunately here, positional authority takes precedence over pretty much any other sort of authority in a lot of the traditional workspaces that we have, which is then such a shame because it leads to a lot of miscommunication and a lot of inability to actually learn and grow with each other rather than just being told what to do. So, you know, could you share with us a little bit more about that transition towards moral authority?
Yeah, I would love to do that, Christine. You know, and I know your culture, and I know it's highly positional, and it's based on tenure, title, position. And what I say is very simple, that if you have authority based upon your position, your title, your age, et cetera, the people in the organization will probably, they'll lend you their hand. They'll do work with you and do work for you. But it's only when you have moral authority that people will begin to give you their heart. And it's the heart that really gets the commitment level and the level of exceeding expectations up to where it really should be. And so you don't hear a lot of people talk about moral authority, but I think that there's a pathway to it. And for your listeners, I just want to very quickly give that to them. The first step is competence, which is nothing more than I have the ability to lead well. And that's got to be the very core of moral authority. You can't have moral authority if you're incompetent. I mean, you've got to be able to deliver time in, time again. And people know that. The second characteristic of a person has moral authority is courage. And they're the person who just basically, they do the right thing. And sometimes they pay the price for doing the right thing. And sometimes it's not popular. And sometimes people disagree with them. But they're courageous. And in their courage, they give other people courage. You know, the word encourage is to put courage in a person. And it's a person with moral authority. They're making the right decisions. And sometimes those right decisions cost the leader. I've had times in my life where I've made decisions and it wasn't the best decision for me, but it was the best decision for the organization. And, you know, courage to put the people before yourself. The third word that really gives moral authority is consistency, which is just basically you just do well all the time, not just sometimes. And so people can depend upon you because you're consistent. And that begins to establish your reputation. That makes people feel secure that are around them. It really allows you to model for others what you want them to have. And finally, for moral authority, there's character. Which is, I call character being bigger on the inside than you are on the outside. But it's all about having integrity. It's all about having authenticity. It's all about being humble. It's all about unconditionally caring and loving people. That's for sure. And that's moral authority. And so few people ever get to that level. And I wrote the whole chapter because I wanted to lay out a path. I've done it very quickly for your listeners, but I want to lay out a path for a person to really have the moral authority, because to me, it's the highest authority of all. You already have the title. You already have the position. But now it's bigger than that. The people follow you not only because of what you've done, they follow you because of who you are.
Absolutely.
And that's big.
Yeah, you know, I think those are all really great points. And thank you for that, you know, great breakdown of that journey towards a moral authority as well. But finally, we've got to kind of get onto this last question here. And your final chapter discusses career to calling. Now, this is something that I think everyone really struggles with, but it's a particular concern for a lot of the incoming or the new workforce. Because there's this idea like if you struggle with not being able to find your calling, or you worry that the job that you're in now isn't what you're like, quote unquote, supposed to do. So for you, how did that change from career to calling come about? And, you know, how could others maybe find a way towards that?
Well, this is probably the most mystical of all chapters. And I really want to help people, if there's a calling for them to find, witness and experience that calling, because I talk in the chapter about the fact that some people wake up to an alarm and some people wake up to a calling. And calling is what solidifies your purpose. Why am I here? And sometimes I call calling a purpose with a divine touch. But, you know, there's a difference between a career and a calling. A career is mainly about you. A calling is mainly about other people. A career is something you choose, and a calling is something that's chosen for you. I think career is a lot of times all about me, but I think calling is not about me at all.
Right.
It's about others. And I think that's where we really get to a level of significance. You know, success is about me and what I've achieved and how much money I make and the homes I have. Significance is all about others and what I've done to add value to their life. And I've known unhappy, successful people, but I've never met an unhappy, significant person. I just haven't. And I think that once you operate under the calling, you begin to live a life of significance that you never forget. And it holds you the rest of your life.
Wow. Okay. I think that's an incredibly powerful note to end on, you know, that a concept of success versus significance. I think that's really, really interesting. And I hope that our listeners can glean something from that and take something away from all these insights. But that about wraps up today's Raise Your Game. Thank you so much, John, for speaking to us today all about leadership.
No, it's been my joy. Thank you very much, Christine.
All right. If you've missed any of this interview, you can download our app on the Apple App Store and also Google Play. You can listen to us on Spotify as well. And if you prefer to be a little bit more old school, you can head over to our website, bfm.my/podcasts, as well to listen to and download the interview again. You have been listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise on BFM 89.9. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.